Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? Welcome to the Around the World podcast. I'm your host, Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more in the Around the World podcast. My guest today is Martin from Germany. We met a couple years ago while we were both living in Madison, Wisconsin. After he finished his master's degree in 2014, Martin took off for a long trip around the United States, South Africa, Australia, and Southeast Asia. Recently, I caught up with him in Cambodia. We spent 2 days checking out the ruins around Angkor Wat, and we took some time off in the middle of a hot day to record this interview. We were at a smaller temple called Neak Pien. There's a narrow walkway over a lake leading to the site, and several stone buildings spread across a grassy pavilion. We searched the area for the quietest place we could find with the least likelihood of being disturbed. We settled on a grassy knoll, away from the main path. You'll hear a few noises in the background, buzzing bugs, chirping birds, crowing roosters, and even a lady chopping wood near us. These sounds remind us that while the temples may be ancient, modern people still live nearby. During the interview, we start by talking about the Hoofer Outdoor Clubs in Madison, Wisconsin, and then we get into rock climbing and whitewater kayaking. Martin has several entertaining stories to share, and it's obvious that even after many months of travel, his wanderlust is alive and well. Maybe he'll even inspire you to take a trip of your own. Hey everyone, we're here with Martin from Germany, and I'm sitting here with him in Cambodia, in one of the ruins near Angkor Wat. Angkor Wat is the most famous ruin, of course, in Cambodia. There's some other temples or ruins spread around, and you can easily spend a few days exploring this area. We've been doing just that for the last 2 days. Now it's about midday, and probably 35 degrees Celsius, 90 or so Fahrenheit, pretty warm day. We're just going to relax in the shade and have ourselves a little chat. So thanks for joining me, Martin. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we knew each other from Wisconsin back when we both lived in Madison, and you come from Germany originally, right?
Yes.
So what brought you to Madison, Wisconsin?
I had the opportunity to study abroad at UW in Madison. And yeah, I took that opportunity because studying abroad in the States is a pretty expensive thing to do if you're not funded, and I was happy to have a scholarship, so I went to Madison.
Cool. So I know it can be quite expensive to study in the U.S., so that's cool to hear. Was this your first university program? Did you study in Germany as well?
Yes.
Before that?
Yeah. I began studying in Germany, mechanical engineering, finished my bachelor's there and part of my master's. And then I finished my master's at UW in Madison. So I studied there and wrote my master's thesis.
Okay. And how long were you in Madison then?
1 year, 2 semesters.
Oh, 1 year. Wow. It feels like we knew each other for a long time. I'm surprised to hear it's only 1 year. But that's how friendships can go sometimes. And we met in the Hoofer's Outing Club originally, and they do a lot of outdoors activities. We're both in a climbing club as well, rock climbing, so we kind of have a lot of stuff in common. We like to get out into wilderness and do some exploration. So did you really enjoy Hoofer's? I mean, what did you think of it?
Hoofer's was amazing.
Yeah?
I did more with the mountaineering club than with the outing club.
Okay.
And I met a few people in mountaineering that I met later again in other continents, and I still have contact with. And in the United States, we had some amazing trips. We went to the Red River Gorge to go climbing. We went
being in Kentucky.
Yes.
Yeah, beautiful area with plenty of not only rock climbing but hiking too.
We went to Vegas to go climbing in the Red Rock Canyon.
Right.
went ice climbing in Wisconsin.
Ice climbing.
Yeah. So that was, I had a really good time. That was amazing. With the Hoffers Clubs. With outing, I went kayaking in the, southeast, in the Carolinas and northern Georgia. That was great too.
This is whitewater.
This is whitewater, yeah. And some smaller trips in Wisconsin, canoeing on the Wisconsin River.
Yeah. So lots of, getting out there and doing some outdoor adventures.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we love doing that in the Hoffers Club. Part of UW-Madison, which is really fantastic for me as well. I actually learned how to climb through them and whitewater kayak both. Is that where you got started?
No, I started in Germany.
Okay.
Kayaking many years ago, climbing a few years before I went to the U.S.
Okay. Well, you kind of continued building your skills with them a little bit at least.
Absolutely.
Especially with climbing.
Yeah. I never went ice climbing before. So was an opportunity I wouldn't have in the area where I come from in Germany.
Oh, there's not much ice climbing there?
No, we don't have that long and harsh winters, so there would be no ice to climb.
Yeah, I should explain this for people. Rock climbing, of course, is climbing on rocks where you have a vertical wall and you're just using your hands and feet to pull yourself up. Ice climbing is something we do in the winter, and there's a couple of different types of ice we can climb. One would be frozen waterfalls, and in the really harsh winters like Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, they have 4 or 5 months of weather, temperatures below freezing. So even some of the bigger waterfalls can completely freeze into a vertical column, and you can climb these using ice axes. It's really cool to watch. It's fun to do. It's super intense, really, really wears you out, but just fantastic. I just love it. Almost as much as rock climbing, actually. Is that kind of how you found it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's different from rock climbing, definitely, but it's big fun. It, makes the long winter in Wisconsin, more like standable for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I know a lot of people like to complain that Wisconsin's winters are so cold, and it's this, a lot of people that I met in Madison kind of talk about, wow, you know, it's a great city overall, fun place to live, but there's always the but, there's like those really cold winters. But I think you just have to get outside or just go with it instead of going against it and just find something fun to do. Maybe that means ice climbing. Maybe it just means snowshoeing or cross-country skiing or ice skating. There's a lot of potential activities in the winter that can take away those winter blues. So you did that for about a year in Madison. Now we're in Cambodia, and we're not really traveling together. We just met up for a couple of days. So can you talk about your trip? You're traveling for a while?
Yeah, I've been actually traveling since I graduated in Madison, and that was in May 2014.
Okay.
So last year, May. And after I graduated, I traveled to States for almost 2 months. Visited a bunch of friends that had internships all over the country.
Were you driving around?
Part of it I was driving, part of it I was flying. Pretty much the beginning of the trip I was driving. I did this road trip out to Utah. Flew from there to Seattle and then Hawaii, back to California, and back to Madison again. And then I went home. After a few weeks in Madison, I went home to Germany.
So first you got a good taste of the United States.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, what were some of the things that you did while you were in the country, or traveling around?
I mostly did road trips.
Classic American road trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With outing or the mountaineering club, what I said earlier. So I wouldn't really backpack in the U.S., but it was more like road tripping, going to national parks, going climbing.
Oh, so even after you graduated, you kept traveling with these clubs, going on trips with them?
Part of it. I visited people I met in the clubs.
Ah, yeah, okay.
And then after doing that, I flew to Hawaii, and that when the backpacking part started, which was definitely not the majority of the trip. So I went to Hawaii, stayed there for 10 days, and then I went to San Francisco, visited only the city pretty much, and then I went home.
Cool. So that was about 2 months, and sounds like you got a good taste of at least the western half of the country.
Yes.
Yeah, although of course you would need years to travel the whole thing. I mean,
absolutely,
it's massive and plenty of stuff to do. So you went home to Germany. Was that it? Were you planning on just staying home at that point in Germany?
No, I got to know this guy in the mountaineering club. He's currently living in South Africa.
Okay.
And he came back to Madison in winter break. And he would go to a club meeting and tell us how amazing South Africa is. He was talking about the wildlife there. He was talking about the climbing there. There's a really famous bouldering area just north of Cape Town. So he was pretty much inviting everybody. If you guys want to visit me in South Africa, then feel free to.
Oh, okay. So you yeah. then took advantage of this. Actually took him up on it.
Exactly.
Cool.
So after a few weeks in Germany, I flew to South Africa, visited him, and we had an amazing time in South Africa. Went to Kruger National Park and a smaller national park in the south of the country. Then road tripped through the whole country from Kruger, which is in the northeast, all the way over to Cape Town, which is in the southwest, pretty much at the southern tip of the country and of the continent. Spent a few days in Cape Town and then went bouldering in the Rocklands.
Bouldering.
Yeah.
So bouldering then is rock climbing, but you don't use any ropes for safety equipment. You typically just use a mattress, but you don't go very high. You go 10, 15 feet up, and that's it. You climb to the top of a boulder, basically. And the point, I guess the main reason people like to do it is because you can do some really hard moves. There's not much consequence. If you just fall a couple of feet, you probably won't get hurt. And you can really push yourself on super hard stuff. So Rocklands is a pretty famous area. How'd that go?
I liked it a lot. The bouldering there is amazing. The rock quality is amazing. There's boulder problems as far as I can reach.
So okay, not crowded at all either?
Not really. So we were there at the end of the season. So there were not many people left. In the main season, it's much more packed. But since the area is so large, you won't have to wait to go bouldering. Maybe you have to wait to do this specific problem. But
okay.
If you just want to go bouldering, you will always find a problem to work on.
Always something empty.
Yeah.
So, and you can get worn out quite quickly with bouldering. Just a couple of problems. You might work on one all day, actually, and for even longer, and before you finish it, but it always feels good to get it done. So what else did you do in South Africa? You had some story you wanted to tell?
Yeah, so I'm in the outdoors, and I really wanted to see the wildlife in Africa, and South Africa is a pretty good place to do that.
Yeah, sure.
So we did two national parks, as I said. The first one I cannot really pronounce. It's something like Huchluwe Imfolosi. But I really don't have the pronunciation down for that one. We did a wilderness walk there. So we were eight, let's say, tourists and two guides. And you just walk through the bush. They provide you with a backpack and a sleeping pad and a sleeping bag, a plate and a spoon, and some communal gear, like cooking stuff, food.
That, they give you food?
Or? Yeah, they give you food to carry around. And then those guys each have a gun. So in case you get attacked by the rhino or the lion, they would be able to take care of it. Luckily, that almost never happens.
Sure, but I imagine in that kind of bush, you really just need to have that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was amazing. We literally hiked through the bush, and we were the only group in that part of the park at that time. You can see footprints of animals. You can see animals from a large distance. We had some close encounters too. We saw some rhino, let's say like 100 meters in front of us on the track. That was really cool. And then you set up a camp, make a fire, cook your food, and then you sleep under the open sky, under the stars.
Really? You're not worried about animals coming in and attacking like in the middle of the night?
That's what you have a night watch for. So the eight of us, the group, we had to split up the night in shifts. So everybody had a 1 hour shift.
Okay, it's not your guides doing this. It's
no, the guides sleep through. The group has to do the night watches, where you make sure that the fire doesn't go out, and you shine your light around to show the animals there's something that they don't know, so they would usually stay away from it.
Right.
In case an animal gets close, uncomfortably close, then you wake up the guide, and he's sleeping next to his gun, so he will take care of it.
All right.
But again, that didn't happen.
Okay.
So it's just a really great experience to sit there alone in your camp, everybody else is sleeping, and you have to take care that no hungry animal comes around.
Yeah, God, I imagine. Well, were you actually able to sleep when you weren't patrolling? I mean, weren't you kind of afraid that something's going to go wrong?
Or? I wasn't afraid at all. I slept like a baby.
Oh, wow. I would think I'd be up all night just kind of wondering, thinking every noise is a rhinoceros coming to plow me over or something.
No, not at all. Mm. First, I was pretty tired because you're like walking around all day.
Ah, okay.
And second of all, you just trust the guy who's doing his shift for the night watch.
Yeah, hopefully they don't fall asleep or anything too.
But yeah, the story that you asked me about.
Yeah, go on.
So we did 3 nights in the bush. The second 2 nights we stayed in the same place. So we would just leave our backpacks in the camp and hike around with our water bottles and our binoculars, literally, so we wouldn't have to carry all that heavy stuff. And the first night, I was there in the winter, so the sun went down pretty early at like around 6. An hour or two after sunset, there was a hyena coming along the river where we camped at, on the other side of the river, and was just looking curious. Hyenas usually patrol their area at night, so there was probably her just daily routine, her nightly routine. And she noticed there's something that hasn't been there before, but she wouldn't bother us. She would
something
just,
being you guys.
Yeah, something
yeah.
being us.
Yeah.
She would just look at us, being curious, but kept her distance. And then the next night, being our last night, I had the first night watch, and everybody was pretty tired, so everybody went to sleep pretty early. So my shift wasn't an hour, but 3 hours. Because it didn't begin at 8, but at 6.
3 hours.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was really hard to stay up.
After all that work.
Yeah, I decided not to sit down, but to stand up all the time, to not, like, close my eyes for a second and then fall asleep for an hour.
Yeah, you'd almost want to, like, walk in circles around your party with the flashlight. And try and think of things to keep you awake.
Yeah.
Wow.
So the same hyena came around. Everybody else was asleep.
This is after it got dark?
Yeah, after it got dark, everybody was asleep, at least laying down.
Yeah.
And it came again, and it came a little bit closer to our camp. Mm. Again, that's their behavior. She saw us the night before, and nothing happened, so this night she got a little bit closer to see what she can get away with.
Testing it.
Yeah, testing it. And I wasn't down at the river. I was on a ledge a little bit further up. So I could see the whole thing kind of from an elevated position. So I was really comfortable up there.
All right. Yeah.
Even a further distance to that animal. Most of the groups, they slept down at the river where the fire was as well. So they were closer to the hyena and they didn't have this elevated position.
Oh, so you weren't right next to the group. You were kind of...
No, I was like 10 meters away, but like 3 meters higher.
Oh, I see. So you were safe, but they weren't.
Yeah. I mean, we all were safe, but I had like a more comfortable position. Let's put it like that.
All right.
And that hyena came closer. I would shine my light at it frequently so that it knew there was something.
Like right in its eyes?
Yeah. You just let the animal know here is something that you don't want to mess with.
Yeah.
And the guide was sleeping like 3 meters away from me, so I could have woken him up pretty fast in case the hyena gets uncomfortably close. But it didn't. So that was really cool. As I said, I was the only person up at that time, seeing that animal just
so you 30 just...
meters, 20, 30 meters away from you,
wow,
walking there.
All alone in the bush, and looking right at you.
Later,
shining a flashlight in its eyes.
Yeah, after the hyena left, I went down to make sure the fire is all right.
Yeah.
And this one guy was sleeping right next to the fire. So he was, first of all, lower and closer to the hyena, and he was really not comfortable with the situation. So he was almost yelling at me for like letting that animal get so close. But I told him that I was up there right next to the guide, So it wasn't dangerous at all, but he was not in his comfort zone anymore.
Not very happy. did the hyena wake him up or something, or how did he find out about it?
I think he was just not asleep yet. I mean, the hyena walked through the shallow water, so you could hear like the feet splash. Maybe that woke him up. I don't know, but he definitely noticed it.
Oh, that's creepy. I mean, yeah, and little splashes like that happen all the time next to a river, so that's where I was kind of getting at. Like, I would just think everything was a hyena, or worse. Wow. Well, so you had a close encounter, but nothing.
I couldn't take pictures of it because it was pitch black.
Sure.
So that's like one of those memories that you don't have a photograph of, but it was really cool.
Yeah, who cares about the picture at that point? You got a good experience out of it. Wow. Well, so you did that for what, 2-3 days?
Yeah, that was
walking through the bush.
4 days, 3 nights.
Oh, that long. Okay.
Yeah. And then we would drive to Kruger, and do some wildlife watching there. In Kruger, you cannot do trips like I explained earlier. You can only like drive in your car or do like day hikes, but nothing overnight. And at night, you have to stay in your campsite, and those are fenced and guarded.
Do you have to stay in because of wildlife or poachers or
both? So first of all, you want to keep the wildlife out, and second of all, the park rangers don't want to have anybody in the park at night because poaching happens at night, and if you're in the park and you're not supposed to be there and they don't know that you don't have permission, they don't know about it. There's anti-poaching units that.
Oh, they don't ask questions?
They don't ask questions, yeah.
Shoot first, ask questions later.
My friend told me a few stories about it, and it's pretty intense.
Wow. Well, and these poachers are mainly coming after, is it just rhinos?
Rhino horn, yeah, that's the main
rhino
problem.
Rhino horn.
Yeah.
So that's still used in some countries, they think it's for medicinal purposes? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's really sad, and we kind of all know that, rhinos are endangered, and you can't just keep killing them to get their horns, but these guys, they probably make a lifetime of money if they happen to get one, I'm guessing.
So the person that actually does the poaching is like a poor guy because he has to do that to make a living. The guys behind that are like the really bad people, the assholes, that enforce the whole thing.
Oh, so they actually take most of it anyway. Oh, man. Yeah, it's a sad situation, but so sounds like South Africa actually at least has some controls on these, and maybe they won't go extinct that quickly. I hope.
I don't know. I'm not deep enough into it, but especially the black rhino is definitely really close to extinction.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's so sad to see. Well, so did you actually see any rhinos?
Yes.
You did?
We see both white and black rhino.
Yeah?
It was pretty lucky to see a black rhino because, as I said, they are endangered. The population is much smaller than the population of the white rhino. Mm. But we've seen them all. We've seen them both.
Cool. Did you see all of the big six, they call it, right?
Big five.
Big five?
Oh. I saw them all, even though, the leopard that I saw was only from a very far distance, like 300 meters.
Wow.
About.
Leopard.
And it was sleeping on a tree.
Oh, okay. 300 meters? Did somebody point it out to you, or did you actually see it?
Somebody pointed it out, and we saw it with our binoculars.
Okay.
But, it's not like you would think of an encounter like to be like 5 meters away from the cat.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've just always been amazed by locals who have lived near wildlife their whole lives. Their ability to identify stuff from far away like that. It's amazing. I just never, you have to show me the thing, and if you go, it's right over there, and I have to look at it for like 3 minutes before I actually see it.
Absolutely. So, yeah. You have to train your eye. I had the same thing. Like people would point out a rhino to me, and it would take me like 5 minutes to see, oh, that's not a rock. That's a rhino.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. They just all blend in at some point. Yeah. But, it's cool. It's cool that you got to see all that.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like you really enjoyed your time there.
Yeah, I loved Africa.
Yeah. Did you just go South Africa or other countries?
We drove through Swaziland as well.
Okay.
But, yeah, the majority of the trip I was in South Africa.
Yeah, did you spend much time in the cities?
Only in Cape Town, actually. My friend lives in Durban, so we were like 2 days in Durban, and then we spent the night at friends of him in Pretoria.
Okay.
But other than that, we've pretty much only been outside, outdoors.
All right. Well, so that's...
Yeah, we slept in our tents most of the times.
Yeah. So you didn't get... I guess a lot of people talk about the danger of South African cities, so you kind of just avoided that altogether.
Yeah. So I have not been to Johannesburg, which is the worst, as far as I know. But we still saw a lot of the poverty.
Yeah. Yeah, that must be sad, too.
That's really sad, and that's... Yeah, it's shocking to see that. It was the very first time I saw Third World.
Okay.
And it's eye-opening.
So until that point, you had just been in, what, Western Europe and the U.S.?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it always is a big shocker, your first time seeing, like, that intense poverty. Yeah. But then you moved on from South Africa. Where did you go next?
I went back to Germany again.
Okay.
Only for a few weeks. And then I went on this trip, spent 2 months in Australia, then 1 month in Vietnam and 1 month in Thailand.
Okay.
And now I'm here.
In Cambodia.
In Cambodia. And in 2 weeks, I'm flying home to Germany again.
Oh, wow. So it's going to end pretty soon.
Yeah, this trip is almost over.
Wow. It just flies by. I mean,
yeah,
it always does. But, yeah, let's talk about Australia. I just came from there. I spent a couple months there as well. We didn't overlap, I don't think, at all in time.
We didn't
meet up there, but I loved it. What did you think?
Australia has some things that are unique to the continent that you won't find anywhere else, especially the wildlife.
Sure, yeah.
So that was what I enjoyed the most, to see koalas in the wild, to see kangaroos in the wild, some spiders and snakes. Luckily, we didn't see too many of them because most of them are venomous.
Yeah. Yeah, right. There's so many things that can kill you.
Yeah. And other than that, Australia has beautiful beaches. We did an amazing trip on Fraser Island.
Where's that?
That's the west coast. It's the east coast. Close to Brisbane, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, so up north.
Yeah. And it's the biggest sand island on Earth.
Biggest sand island on Earth.
Yeah.
Okay. Just sand?
Yeah, it's just sand. I mean, there's vegetation, but there's no soil.
Oh, no soil. So yeah. There's some palm trees. And...
Yeah. So the island is pretty big, and you have pretty dense forests there, but it's only sand, so you need like a four-wheel drive to go there.
To travel across it.
Yeah.
Okay. So you go there by boat, and then.
Yeah, you take the ferry, and they offer like tours where they drive you around in a four-wheel drive, or you drive the four-wheel drive by yourself, which we did. And there's some really, really amazing places. Like Lake McKenzie is one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen so far, I'd say.
Oh, okay, it's big enough to have a lake.
Yeah,
it's that big.
There's freshwater lakes on the island. It's just like a painting. So it's blue water, bright white beaches.
Wow.
Palm trees in the back. It's amazing.
Cool. Do people live there?
I'm not too sure about it. So it's Aboriginal land. So the Aboriginals used to live there. I don't know if there's, still Aboriginal villages. There's, hotels and all of that stuff and camps. But I don't know if there's like, if there are people permanently living that are not, like having a hotel or so.
Oh, okay. So it's just when you first said Sand Island, I was picturing even though you said it's the biggest in the world,
yeah.
I still didn't think of you staying overnight there. So there's actually infrastructure.
Yeah, there's infrastructure. There's just no roads.
Oh, wow. No roads, but there's hotels and water. Yeah. And so you can live in the comforts of home.
Yeah, they have
even
running,
on this island.
They have running water. They have electricity. You drive mainly over the beach. So at low tide, the sand is so compact that it's almost like a paved road. At high tide, you have to drive through the soft sand, which is a little bit more challenging.
You actually drove?
Or? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I did this trip where they put up to six people in a four-wheel drive, and then you switch driving. and you follow one lead vehicle. It's like three vehicles following one lead vehicle, and then you drive off the island and stop at certain places.
Oh, so it's a guided tour, but yeah, they let you still drive at least a couple of the vehicles.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool, though. Like, get that experience.
Absolutely, like, yeah. It would have been more fun to totally do it on your own. Now that I know how it works, I would probably do that. But I've never been really driving off-road. So, and I didn't have a four-wheel drive when I was in Australia.
Well, it's a great introduction to it, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it probably makes you want to do it more.
Yeah, now I want to have a beach and an off-road drive.
Yeah, sure.
A four-wheel drive.
So did you do a lot of driving in Australia?
Yeah, so I met this other German guy. We got to know over Facebook. And we kind of had the same idea in the same time frame. So we rented vans and then drove down the East Coast and then traveled the West Coast after that. We did a lot of driving. It was like close to 5,000 kilometers at the East Coast and a little bit more than 7,000 kilometers at the West Coast.
Whoa.
Australia is large.
Whoa, 12,000 Ks.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, 8,000 miles, let's say. That's a lot of driving. In 2 months.
In 2 months, yeah.
Okay. So hopefully these rental vans that you had were unlimited mileage.
Yeah, yeah. They are unlimited mileage. And the one that we had at the West Coast had like 440,000 kilometers down before we got it.
So before you started.
Yeah, those cars get a lot of mileage.
Sure. There are. What kind of vehicle was it?
It was like some Toyota minivan.
Oh, one of those. Okay. Yeah. But not four-wheel drive.
No.
Okay.
So it was three-wheel drive.
Just one of these vehicles that keeps on going.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess minimal repairs. So did you drive, okay, you drove the West Coast and the East Coast. Did you, you must have taken some of these really long drives where there's just like nothing in between towns and cities. Any encounters with kangaroos or anything like that? I mean,
we didn't hit any.
We didn't hit any.
Of course, we've seen a bunch.
Yeah, okay.
Australia has like a kangaroo problem. I didn't know that before I went. But they actually have too many of them, and they are roaming the streets after dark. So, yeah.
Do they have their boxing gloves on, looking to take on any people walking around? The gangs come out.
They're standing in the middle of the road and looking stupid when they're like in your high beams.
Yeah, they're not caring, huh? So you had to dodge them, or did you just not drive?
We didn't drive after the sun went down. So that's what they tell you. You shouldn't do, in case you don't have a real good lighting system on your car.
You
just shouldn't drive at night.
Oh yeah, I've seen some of these trucks that they have in Australia that the people who live in the country where there's massive lights on top. They're just super bright, and yeah. I guess that's to see the kangaroos or scare them away. Yeah. Maybe
it's not only kangaroos; it's all sorts of wildlife on the roads. But yeah, you want to have that if you drive at night.
It's a really wild place. So you did some of these long trips between towns. You were telling me about an interesting story before. You want to go into that?
So yeah. So we were driving at the West Coast. I think we were coming out of Exmouth. That's in the north. And we were driving inland towards Kurinji National Park. And on those outback highways, there's nothing. There's like only a very few towns, and other than that, you only have roadhouses to fill up your car.
Roadhouse is just what, a gas station, basically?
It's pretty much a gas station, a small grocery store.
Sometimes
they serve food like at the restaurant, but really nothing much more. And you really should gas up at each of those, because you only get like every 200 to 300 kilometers, you get one.
Yeah, I've heard some of these are even government funded, I think, because there's just not enough people to even warrant having one. So I've heard this, at least, that the government will subsidize these.
I don't know about that. I know that the gas at those road houses is way more expensive than in the cities.
Ah, sure.
And I guess that's, but part of the reason is that they have to bring the gas out to those road houses.
Yeah.
And there's not much traffic coming by. But anyways, you should fill up at each of those. And we had a map where there was this roadhouse, and a few kilometers further there was a town on the map. And we decided to try to fill up at that town because we expected that town to be cheaper than the roadhouse. So we would drive past the roadhouse and then drive on. And at some point we were asking ourselves, when would this town come?
Where is it?
And then we had to stop at this construction, road construction. And we were asking the road workers, and they said, like, the next place to gas up, it's like 200 kilometers on.
Oh, so they told you this.
Yeah, so this place obviously didn't exist anymore. And then we would look in another map that we had in the car. And it had this small but very important comment next to the name of the town saying abandoned.
Oh, abandoned. So, and the other map didn't bother to write that word.
No.
Oh, okay. So you started out on this, what seems logical, right? Like, let's just stop in the town and the roadhouse is gonna be overpriced. But the town doesn't exist, and now by the time you realize this, you're pretty far past the roadhouse, right?
So we would have made it back, but we didn't really want to because it would have taken a lot of time. So we tried to make it to the next gas station, which was a stupid idea. And then we would drive on and on, and then we switched off our AC. Tried to drive slow to save gas, to increase the gas mileage.
Praying that it works a little bit.
Still didn't work.
Hold your breath.
50 kilometers in front of the next gas station, we ran out of gas.
The inevitable.
So you're standing there in the middle of the desert, like stranded.
Yeah, and we're laughing about it now, but.
Yeah, I mean, it was the middle of the day, so we had a pretty good chance that cars would come by. And we, like, weren't lost for the night or so. And we had enough water and food to even make it through the night. It would have just been a pain.
Okay.
Because we would have lost time. And then after 20 or 30 minutes, there was this car coming by. They wouldn't have gas with them, but they at least had a spot free. So I hitchhiked to the next gas station, bought this gas canister, and it was $40 Australian just for the container.
Not to fill it.
Yeah, just the container. And then.
So that's like over 30 US, 32 US.
It was 30 euros. I don't know how much it is in American dollars.
Oh, 30 euros?
Yeah, 40 Australian, 30 euros.
Oh,
or around. I have 30 euros in my head. I don't know. Maybe it was 42.
Well, a lot
Australian.
Less, yeah,
it was. It was much. It was like,
well, they got you, right?
Like more than double what you would have paid in like a hardware store or so.
Sure, they probably see you walking in like all sweaty and grimy, and they just kind of they know it's coming. We got this guy. We got a monopoly on these gas canisters.
Yeah.
So all right, so you overpaid for that. Yeah.
And then I walked back to the end of the town. To hitch a ride back.
Well, so you filled it, right?
You got gas. Of course, I had to.
Yeah, you got a couple liters anyway, or whatever it was.
I bought a 10-liter canister, filled it up.
Okay.
Walked back, and then tried to hitch a ride back home, back to the car, not home.
Yeah.
Which took me a while. There were a few cars coming by, but they wouldn't go where I wanted to go.
There's more than one road here?
No, there was like a dump site or whatnot, just a few kilometers out of the town.
Ah, okay.
And many trucks went there, and there were no cars coming by. And then there was this road train, just driving out of the town. And
a road train.
Yeah, a road train. So like a semi with 3 to 4 trailers.
Yeah. So they have these in Australia between during the really long straight stretches to save fuel. They'll just throw like 4 trailers together and hitch them up to a semi and. It can't really turn, right? These things aren't very maneuverable, but you don't really need it to be maneuverable there.
Yeah.
So
you have long stretches of straight roads, so you couldn't imagine something like that in Europe.
Right.
Maybe not even in the States, but
in
Australia.
Alps or something.
You can do that. Yeah. Trying to go over passes in the Alps. But, in Australia they do have those, and they, they are pretty long and pretty heavy and have, and they need a long way to break because they're so long, heavy. And I did not expect that truck to break for me or to stop for me, but I still tried it.
Tried hitching?
Yeah, I tried hitching.
Stuck your thumb
out. And he would break.
You hit the brakes?
Yeah, and he would stop. And then I like explained what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go. And he said, yeah, jump in. And that was really cool. On that drive, it was only 50 kilometers. I would have loved it to be longer because it was just so interesting to talk to that truck driver.
So what did he tell you?
I was asking all those questions about the vehicle itself, like how heavy those things can be and, like how far they go. He was telling me that they wouldn't have cruise control in these things because the government took it out for like safety reasons, which I kind of see, but I also see that it's like a pain to like press down the pedal if you're driving 10 hours a day.
Sure, always keeping your foot at the same angle. Yeah, that gets tiring, even in a car.
He had this piece of wood that he would put between the accelerator and...
way safer, wedging a piece of wood in to not have cruise control.
That was his cruise control.
What could possibly go wrong there? Was the safety thing to keep them from falling asleep and like keep their foot occupied so they reason?
If they would fall asleep and you have like 120, 150 tons
going there news.
Constantly at the same speed, then it's like it's a lot of impact.
It's a lot of force.
Yeah, a lot of damage that you can do. So I think that's the reason.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, and I. What comes to mind for me is if it's icy, not in Australia, but anywhere it's icy, you shouldn't use your cruise control because if you hit a patch, your tires will start spinning automatically and they could spin you out of control. Mm. I wonder if there's something to do with, not exactly that, but something similar in Australia with these huge trucks, with the sheer mass that's coming down the road. I mean, I don't know. We'll have to look into that.
But, but what he told me is... if the trailers are empty, at least don't have that much weight on them, he really has to be careful with the brakes. So he cannot slam the brakes because otherwise the trailers would overtake him because the tires block or lock.
They must have some special braking system then?
They don't have ABS. That surprised me. But he has to be really careful with braking when the trailers are empty.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess there's probably... special training and a special type of license to get one of these. It sounds pretty dangerous, but it makes total sense in Australia that they'd have these. So, yeah, you're saying that they built these things are built up in front, right? They have a huge grill or something. Mm. Is that right?
They have these huge bull bars. Because I was saying earlier that they have a lot of wildlife on the roads at night. And with those huge trucks, you cannot, like, maneuver around the kangaroos on the road.
Oh, yeah, no way.
Because you can only do slight, like, changes, and you have to do them early.
Yeah.
Sometimes he said they could get around the animals, but, if he sees that there's, like, a kangaroo in the middle of the road or, like, a cow or whatnot, he would just hit it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he can't, if you swerve, that whole thing's going off. I don't know if that's still called jackknifing at that point, or maybe there's some other word, circle knifing or something. I don't know. That would be bad. So they just run right into the kangaroos, huh? And I imagine there's not much left of a kangaroo after one of those things.
He said, and it's kind of horrible. It was a little bit funny to see the kangaroos just bouncing off the trail.
Oh,
truck.
No. Oh man! So you probably need to you need a good stomach, I guess, to take on that job. It's probably one of the things, the least likely things that you'd think of to put on your resume that you don't get squeamish around blood to get this license. Boy, these things sound interesting. I was hoping to hitchhike on one of them actually from Adelaide out to Perth, but I was told it's just kind of difficult, and given my time constraints, I couldn't. I ended up taking the train, which was cool, but it's really cool to hear that you were able to hitchhike on one of them. I'm a little bit jealous, even if it was just a short distance.
Yeah, I would have loved it to be longer. But yeah, that's the only good thing about that running out of gas situation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, it's too bad you didn't run out of gas sooner. You would have had more. You should have been hitting the gas instead of slowing down and turn up the AC.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so then everything was fine. You filled up.
And yeah, before
on
that.
Your way.
Yeah. You had the bitter pill to swallow that it was a little bit expensive to buy that canister, which we didn't need after that anymore. We always kept it full in our trunk just in case.
Oh, as a jerry can. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea.
But we never needed it again. And it was a rental car, so we would just give it back to the rental company after that.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. So we tried to sell it, but nobody really wanted to have it, and we wouldn't really have time to sell it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh, you could have siphoned someone's gas out of their tank and wait for them to show up. Fill it with their gas and sell it right back to them. Okay, kids, don't do that at home. That was just a joke. All right. So you did Australia for a couple of months. It sounds like you had some great experiences. Where'd you go after that then?
From Australia, I went to Vietnam.
Vietnam. And how was that? Was that a big change from Australia?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was the first country I really visited in Africa. In Asia. I've been to Dubai before, but that's not really Africa. Not really Asia.
Not what we think of anyway. Even though it's on the Asian continent.
It is on the Asian continent, but it's not the Asian culture.
Yeah.
And then Vietnam was totally different. It's much cheaper. You have like the Asian culture there. It's really cheap and easy to travel.
Okay. Can you get by with English there? Is that okay?
Yeah, it's usually fine. I went into a few places where people wouldn't speak English, but then like if you have the necessary words kind of in your dictionary or on your phone, then you can always survive. Like you will always get some food.
Oh, written in Vietnamese, you mean?
Yeah.
The words written out.
Yeah,
okay.
Or like a translator app, something like that.
Okay. So not
that's
too
really
bad.
Not an issue. Yeah, and then you come from Australia to Vietnam, and all of a sudden, a hostel room is not a hostel bed is not $25 anymore, but $6.
Yeah,
and going out for dinner is not $10, but $2.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the. I mean, I love Australia. The one negative is that it's so expensive.
It is.
But everything else about it's great. But so, Vietnam sounds really cool too. Would you recommend that as your first country in Southeast Asia, or would you?
I had an easy time to start in Vietnam. I've heard that it was not recommended to start in Vietnam. I wouldn't see why. If you want to have an easier access, you probably want to start in Thailand.
Thailand, okay.
I went to Thailand after Vietnam, and Thailand is much more touristy, much more backpackers around, so you will find other people that are kind of in the same boat to get like information from them where to go, what to do, how to do things.
Okay, so but is Vietnam not touristy or is it just less?
It's less touristy.
You'll still meet people.
Sure, you do. Like they have hostels there, but it's just not that packed with backpackers as Thailand is.
Okay, so that kind of sounds like a bonus to me.
Yeah. If you want to see. See Asian culture and really, see the culture, get to know the country, then that's much easier in Vietnam than it is in Thailand, I feel.
Okay. And Vietnam's a really long country. I'm actually going there soon. I haven't been there yet. Looking forward to it. But so, did you go from top to bottom or bottom to top? Or
yeah, I started in. So I went from top to bottom. I started in Hanoi.
Hanoi, okay.
And then pretty much went down to Ho Chi Minh. From Hanoi, I first went up north to Sapa. That's like a mountain village where you can do some trekking and you can do homestays at like mountain villages.
Oh, okay.
That was really cool.
Get to know that culture then,
yeah.
Too. Homestay, what is that where you just stay with a family?
Yeah.
You just pay them some money and
exactly.
They take you in for a day or two.
I knew that would be possible, so I didn't book anything. I was just arriving at the bus stop pretty early in the morning. And those people are standing there at the bus stop and offer their homes to stay for you. And they provide you with food. They show you around, like this woman, she went hiking with me and a few other tourists to their village. And then you just sleep at their house.
Okay, so it's not just like a hotel.
Not at all.
You really learn. You really get to meet them.
Yeah, you are in their private place.
Oh, that's good. That's one of the things I like personally about traveling is meeting the local people.
Yeah.
So if that's a good way to do it. Yeah, and that's in a mountain town?
Yeah, so that's in the mountainous area in northern Vietnam.
Oh, is it actually cold there? Or?
It was way cold. Sapa is the coldest place in Vietnam. I was there in January, and at night it got down to around freezing. During the day, it was okay, like 15, 20 centigrade.
Okay. So that'd be like maybe upwards of 60, 65?
Yeah, something like that.
Fahrenheit, so... Yeah, that's a pretty extreme change in temperature from day to night, which I found happens a lot in mountain towns. But wow, I never thought of Vietnam as being kind of cold. I've always just thought of it as this overwhelmingly hot country.
They have like different climate zones there. I was there in the winter, and the northern part, like the mountains in the north, are really cold in the winter, at least at night. But that's also the dry season. So in the summer it would rain a lot. If you go further south, like around Ho Chi Minh, it was really warm, like 30 centigrade.
Okay. So like 80 Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, well, and that's probably the temperature year round, I'm guessing, somewhere around there.
I am not sure.
Oh, well.
I don't know about the temperatures in the summer. Generally they say, like December to February would be the best time to travel Southeast Asia. But that's just in general, so it doesn't really apply for Vietnam. Depending on where you want to go in Vietnam, you have different time frames.
Okay.
For instance, the central part was rainy when I was there, so I couldn't really enjoy that part. And that's nice in like May.
Oh, so yeah. There's just a small area that has a dry season that's different than the rest.
As far as I understand.
Oh, that's interesting. All right. Well, so, but otherwise, in the Northern Hemisphere, winter is time to go, and that's always a good time to get away, unless if you really like ice climbing and don't want to leave the winter. Most people are looking to get away from it. Cool. So, after Vietnam, you, what, headed out west to, did you just fly to Thailand next?
Yes.
Is that it?
Yeah, because I wanted to meet... my friend Dan in Cambodia. I skipped Cambodia from there, so logically it would have made sense to go through Cambodia to Thailand. But I skipped Cambodia at that point and went straight to Thailand. Flew from Ho Chi Minh City to Bangkok. And then traveled Thailand for a month. The same day I arrived, I took the night train up to Chiang Mai, which is in northern Thailand.
Okay.
Spend some time in Chiang Mai. There's a few temples to visit. It's actually a pretty cool city just to hang out.
Is it near the beach or?
No, it's in the mainland. There's no beach. The beaches are in southern Thailand.
Ah, okay.
And then I rented a motorbike and did like a motorbike trip around Chiang Mai for 3 days. That was really cool. There's, a lot to see, like in more remote villages that are not that frequently traveled by backpackers. So you will find those places in Thailand as well.
So you can get away from
absolutely,
the
yeah,
real
it's
tourist
just,
season.
Harder to find, I'd say. And the touristy destinations are really touristy compared to Vietnam. Like the, it's definitely different. I didn't see that many backpackers in Vietnam that I saw in Thailand.
Okay. Well, it's good to know. Yeah. So, renting a motorbike is, that's pretty easy and accessible. And
yeah. So you don't even need a license. they keep your passport.
Okay.
Just as a deposit.
Okay.
Or you'd leave them like whichever amount of money in case you break the bike or you break parts of it. And then you bring the bike back. And if you didn't damage anything, they give you your passport back. Sometimes they scam you. I've heard that they would tell you like you caused these scratches and they ask a lot of money for it, even though they were there before. But the place where I went to, they like walked around the bike with me beforehand and like marked on a sheet of paper, they marked all the damage that has been done to the bike before. I also took some pictures of the bike just to be sure. So you just have to be aware of that, but it's not like everybody wants to screw you over.
Yeah, good to know. I mean, I've heard of that happening in many places, even in wealthy countries.
Probably,
too.
Yeah.
So good to know. We just take some pictures of the vehicle and inspect it, and then you're fine. What about driving a motorcycle in Thailand? Is that terrifying, or was it okay?
Among the Asian countries that I've been to, being Vietnam, Thailand, and Cambodia, in Thailand you have the safest traffic, like the most regulated traffic, let's say. They drive on the left side of the road.
They do.
Oh. But I was used to that from Australia.
Sure.
But other than that, it was not a problem at all. I've been driving motorbikes before, so I knew how to like ride a geared bike. So there was no problem. In Vietnam, it was more interesting, but still, it's all right. Like you want to be careful in the beginning and see how it goes, but you'll adapt to it pretty fast. However, like I didn't drive bikes in the big cities like in Hanoi or in Ho Chi Minh. That's a different story, but in smaller towns, you can definitely like get a scooter and drive around.
Oh, okay, there's more
no problem.
More laid back, less traffic.
Yeah, they don't ask for a license. They didn't even ask for my passport when I got the bike. They just you give them a few dollars and then they tell you to bring the bike back at night.
Oh, they trust you.
Yeah, yeah. I was surprised, but yeah, that's how it goes there.
Oh, that's cool. It's good to hear. That sounds like a good adventure. So in Bangkok, before we started talking here on this interview, you were telling me about an interesting experience that you had that was pretty unique. You want to fill us in on that?
Sure. So I met this girl in Ho Chi Minh. She studied for a semester in Bangkok, and I told her that I was about to go to Bangkok and was asking her what there is to do. And she knew that I was like an outdoorsy person. I like to do stuff off the beaten track. And she told me about this abandoned building. It's called Bangkok Ghost Tower. So you can find that online.
Bangkok Ghost Tower?
Yeah.
An abandoned building, huh?
So it's a skyscraper. It's like 50 stories, around about 180 meters. They started building it back in the 90s, and then the Asian financial crisis happened.
Oh, right, I remember that.
Yeah. They ran out of money, so they stopped the construction. And it's like this halfway finished building.
Oh, they never finished it, even when things got better.
No, they didn't.
Just done.
Yeah. It's built all the way up, so it's 50 stories high, but there are no windows. Sometimes there's no railings at the balconies. There's no elevators. There's a lot of pretty deep holes, so you really want to watch your steps there.
So just an empty shaft you can fall down instead
exactly,
of an elevator.
Yeah.
Oh man!
But it's really cool. You go there and then the locals will like let you in. It's not all the way on the legal side, I think, but you can go in there. You give them a few baht, and they let you in. And then you walk up those 50 stories and explore the building.
Okay.
It's really interesting. It's nice views from up there. I can absolutely recommend doing that.
Cool. I mean, does it feel like it's going to fall down when you're walking up the stairs? Does
no.
it feel rickety at all? Or?
I mean, there's a few spots that looked a little bit like a chossy, I would say, in the climbing terms. Maybe you could find a better word.
Ready to fall apart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But overall, it was... Everything I stepped on was solid. So I'm still alive.
Yeah, I'm talking to you here. Yeah. So if you're up for a different type of adventure, that sounds like a good one to try out. And at the top, I mean, you, no real worries about police seeing you or anything?
So people go there all the time. When I went there, I met like altogether like 6-7 other people being in that building at that time.
Oh, so this isn't like completely secret that we're
No, it's online. People know about that. It's not in the guidebooks though, I think.
Okay.
But people know about that.
So just watch your step and
yeah.
And you'll be all right if you do it, and
I probably won't
get in trouble or anything.
I don't know if like if police would arrest you if they see you.
Just kick you out or something.
The local that got me let me in. He told me to stay away from one side of the building because of the police.
Okay.
But I don't know if they would kick your butt or kick his butt for letting me in.
Oh, right, right. He might be more in more trouble than you.
Yeah, I don't know, but I was fine, and I met people that have been there many times, and they said they didn't have any issues.
Oh, it's a place you can keep coming back to.
Yeah, sure you can.
Cool. So then you came to Cambodia and met up with me and a few of my friends, and we're checking out Angkor Wat right now and done a few other things here. What do you think you're going to do after? Oh, you said you're going home soon.
Yeah, I have to go home in 2 weeks.
I made
the mistake to book a flight home. I started regretting that like 2 months ago.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So you just kind of knew this date was looming in the distance
I should have just gotten a one-way flight and go home whenever I feel like, but...
Just buy a ticket out whenever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the way to go for sure. If you aren't entirely sure, you don't have a hard deadline to come back home to. So what, you think you'll take off again once you go back to Germany?
I'm not sure yet. So I just graduated from college.
Yeah.
The initial plan was to come back home and apply for a job. Right now I'm not feeling like I've seen enough of the world. So I'm still contemplating if I take off right away or how do I do that. I have to go home. I go home because I have this flight I cannot change. And then I have the option to to get grounded a little bit at home.
Yeah.
See my friends and family again and see how I feel.
Make some money, maybe.
Yeah.
Build up the coffers. Yeah, okay. But the wanderlust is still there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Sounds like you're not going to stop traveling anytime soon, even if you do settle in a little bit.
I mean, we get like 6 weeks off of work every year in Germany, which is a lot compared to other countries.
Oh, it's so nice.
But you usually won't have the option to take those 6 weeks in one consecutive time frame. You can like take 2 weeks off here, maybe 3 weeks off there, depending on your employer.
So not really enough time to do a serious trip.
Exactly. So it's more like holiday than it is traveling, I'd say.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's new to me as well. I never really worked full time, so
yeah.
I'll see how that goes.
Cool. Well, I mean, you're a hardworking guy and you've done a master's in mechanical engineering.
Yes.
And I'm sure things will work out fine for you. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, you know, I was a software engineer. I've done that a few times, and I've come and gone, and I didn't really have any trouble finding more work. And hopefully things will be the same for you if you want to work for a few years, kind of stick around home, explore Germany for a bit. You can always take off again.
Sure.
Just so you know, the wanderlust doesn't really ever go away. You're never going to get out of your system, but at least there's always more places to explore. And
absolutely.
You've had a great start on it.
The bad thing that I'm feeling about traveling right now is the more countries I get off of the list to be visited, the more I get on the list to be visited again.
Oh, so. You want to come back there? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, these lists are kind of... Everyone's got their own technique, right? But just saying take care of a country or, you know, check it off, it almost seems silly to me. You're never going to see even a whole country.
No.
Maybe you could spend like your entire life in Germany and never work a day and travel the entire country, go to every little village and see the whole, you can say I've seen all of Germany, but you're not going to do that with the world.
No.
Our lives just aren't long enough for that to happen.
Yeah, it's sad but true.
But it's sad, but it's cool that you always have new places to go. Even you talk to someone who's traveled their whole life, there are places they have not gone yet that are interesting. So that's the plus side of this whole travel thing. But we're running short on time here. It's been a really interesting discussion. Thanks for taking some time out to chat with me, Martin. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Around the World podcast. Special thanks to Martin for joining me. For more information, you can visit my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. From there, you can sign up to get updates from this podcast delivered directly to your inbox. Remember, the Around the World podcast is all about meeting ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. Thanks for listening.